I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Former Pennsylvania Attorney General Kathleen Kane left the Norristown courthouse this month in handcuffs after being sentenced to 10 to 23 months for perjury and other offenses related to the abuse of her office. The next attorney general's job is to restore integrity and confidence inside and outside that office, whose job is to prosecute public corruption, consumer fraud, drug rings, and other major crimes. Our guest, Josh Shapiro, is the Democratic candidate for attorney general. He was a congressional aide in Washington, D.C. He served in the Pennsylvania legislature beginning in 2004 when he was 30 years old and became Montgomery County Commissioner in 2012. He was appointed by Governor Wolf as chairman of the Pennsylvania Commission on Crime and Delinquency. And he joins us on Radio Times to talk about what he wants to do if elected next week. His Republican rival, John Rafferty, is our guest on Friday. And Josh Shapiro, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Great to be back with you. Thank you.
You're welcome. Let me begin with Kathleen Kane. Did the punishment fit the crime, 10 to 23 months for her offenses?
Look, obviously, she needed to be punished, and I respect the decision of the judge. I think the real question now is, how do we move forward? In the first breath of my campaign back in January, I put out an integrity agenda, a plan to try and make sure that we restore people's confidence in the system and make sure that we clean up that office. We're going to make sure that everybody in the attorney general's office submits to a code of conduct. Everyone goes through mandatory ethics training. We ban all gifts because we don't want anybody in the prosecutor's office to be perceived as being for sale. We're going to have far more openness and transparency when it comes to our spending. I'm going to hire a chief diversity officer because I think a number of the bad decisions that have been made there, whether it's the email scandal, which I'm sure we'll get into, and other issues, is because there's been a lack of diversity around the table. And finally, because this isn't going to be a one-and-done issue, I'm going to establish a Casey Commission named after former Governor Casey, one of the leaders on ethics and integrity in Pennsylvania, to make sure that a group of citizens and lawyers and academics and journalists and others from the outside are constantly and consistently reviewing our policies and procedures internally. Look, Marty, I'm someone my entire career who's led on the issues of ethics and integrity. And now more than ever, we need someone in that office who's going to continue that movement forward.
There's a special prosecutor, Doug Gansler, who is looking at these emails that came to light, determining, I guess, which ones will get released, which ones won't. What's your position on that? Should he have this job?
My position is very clear. Those emails need to be released. And if they're not released by the time I become attorney general, I will release them. But the only thing I might redact is someone's, you know, Social Security number or personal information, which I think you and your listeners would agree to. There's a deeper issue here with these emails that I want to highlight. Obviously, it is very concerning when you have people swapping racist, misogynistic, homophobic, pornographic emails back and forth with one another. And those individuals should be held to account and should be punished. But I think the deeper issue here is that it has caused people in Pennsylvania to question whether or not the justice system is really working for them. Think about it. If you're a woman in Pennsylvania, if you're a person of color, you have to wonder when the leaders of the justice system, two disgraced former Supreme Court justices, judges, lawyers, deputy attorney generals, others swapping these emails, you have to wonder whether or not the system is really working for them. I'm going to restore that basic sense of fairness and that confidence that people need to have in their justice system to know that the law will be applied without fear and without favor.
We did a lot of shows about Kathleen Kane, the allegations against her, and then, of course, her conviction as well. And I would say, looking at the kind of email traffic and calls that we got, some people said she embarrassed herself, she embarrassed the office. Others said she was railroaded after she uncovered these pornographic emails. So I think the public, it's not scientific, but that the public is divided about whether she was railroaded or not.
Look, I think she undermined the justice system, and she deserves to pay for the crimes that she committed. I do think that there's also a question about whether or not the system is fair. I happen to think it's rigged against certain people, and a good example of that are these emails, that you have people of color, you have women, you have our LGBTQ brothers and sisters wondering whether or not they're going to get a fair shot anymore when the leaders of the justice system are sending thousands of emails, not just making fun of them, but insulting them and creating an environment where their legal rights weren't going to be protected.
Is that a firing offense, or is it by releasing them you're saying to the public, these are the people who might sit on your case, for
instance? very clear that these emails, I think, effectively need to be divided into three buckets, right? One bucket is, was a crime committed as a result of these emails being sent back and forth? The second bucket is, were there ethics violations? And the third bucket is, were there HR violations, human resources violations? Obviously, any HR violations within the Attorney General's office, I'm going to deal with. These people will not be working for me.
They'll be fired?
If I become Attorney General. I will not tolerate that kind of behavior. And I want to make sure that the people surrounding me, not just the 900 employees in the office, but the smaller table where a lot of these big decisions get made, are made up of people who look like the people in Pennsylvania that we are sworn to represent. Diversity is not only good government, but you get a far better result when you have competing opinions and differing opinions around the table, making sure that you're being far more tolerant and understanding of others.
So if someone sent a racist or homophobic or misogynist email, they will be fired if you become the Attorney General?
They will not be working for me, correct.
Is there a difference between being fired and not working for you?
No, I mean, you're asking me to talk about an HR policy on someone I don't know in an office I have not achieved yet. What I want to make clear is that I have no tolerance for those individuals. They won't be part of my administration, period. Whether they're gone before I get there obviously remains to be seen.
Let me give out the phone number, and it's 1-888-477-9499 to join our conversation. You can call us at I already did that. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation. Again, Josh Shapiro, our guest, Democratic candidate for Attorney General here in Pennsylvania. And again, his Republican rival, John Rafferty, is our guest on Friday. You do not have courtroom experience. That's been one of the critiques of your extensive biography. How will you make up for that if you become the Attorney General?
Marty, it's important that we look first nationally and then come back to the state, and I'm happy to answer your question directly. Nationally, 40% of our nation's attorneys general were not prosecutors before they achieved that position. You know what they were? They were county executives and mayors. They were legislators. They were leaders of state agencies. They were leaders in private practice. I've been all of those things. I think I have a unique set of skills and an extensive background to lead this office now. And right now, more than ever, we need someone with executive experience. We need someone who understands how to clean up a mess, as I've done leading Montgomery County's government, and who understands how to use this office to its fullest potential. Probably my biggest critique of this office over many attorneys general, not just the last one, has been the failure to use the office to its full entirety. You know, we have obviously the criminal division as well as the civil division, which is where you represent the Commonwealth when they're sued. But there's a huge chunk of this that's really never been utilized, the public protection division. I talk all across the Commonwealth about wanting to be the people's attorney general, someone who goes out and protects our seniors from scams, someone who deals with predatory practices against our consumers, someone who's finally going to tackle the heroin epidemic and get illegal guns off our streets. We've got to do a far better job and use this office to its fullest potential. And I've got the background and the skill set to do just that.
How, though, do you prioritize that? I'm looking at your agenda here. Hold big companies and powerful interests accountable. Ensure safe, clean drinking water. Take on the heroin epidemic. Gun safety, integrity, protecting seniors, advancing women's rights. You're going to have to prioritize. That's a pretty extensive, and there's more here. Prioritize what you want to do.
Look, I know how to walk and chew gum, and I think I've proven that in Montgomery County. Taking over a bureaucracy was actually four times larger than the office of Attorney General. It was a mess almost 5 years ago when we took over, and literally by every objective measure, we've turned it around. I'll do the same thing in the Attorney General's office. I will focus priorities. I will provide real leadership. I will surround myself with smart, competent, tough, ethical people, and we're going to get the most out of that office and really protect and meet the needs of the people of Pennsylvania. It is possible to do all of those things. You just need strong leadership and competent management, and I've got a track record of doing that.
Well, let me ask you about a couple of them, one including stricter gun safety laws, and you've gotten, about $250,000 from Mayor Bloomberg's gun organization. When you talk about stricter gun safety laws, what does that include?
This is a defining issue in this race. My opponent, and I say this with respect, I've run a 100% positive campaign, but I think this is on the substance, an issue where there's clear contrast. I'm sure you'll ask him about it as well. You know, he has an A-minus rating from the NRA. He has always stood down to the gun lobby, and I will stand up to the gun lobby. And what does that specifically mean when you're Attorney General? What it means is that you're going to combat straw purchasers. That's where people can't buy guns legally, and so they buy – excuse me, they can't buy them legally. They send someone else in to buy them, and then they sell them out the back door illegally. That's a straw purchaser. We're going to crack down on that. We're going to take our gun violence task force that exists here in the city of Philadelphia, partnering with police commissioner, DA, sheriff, and others to combat illegal guns in our cities. I'm going to beef that up, and I'm going to extend it out to other places that are racked by gun violence, whether it's the city of Chester, Reading, Allentown, Erie, Hazleton, communities all across Pennsylvania I have visited that are racked by gun violence. I'm going to negotiate directly with the NRA to close the gun show loophole. We need to have universal background checks here in Pennsylvania to make sure that guns aren't getting in the hands of criminals or those who are mentally ill. And by the way, 90% of gun owners agree with me on that issue that we should have universal background checks. We need an attorney general who's going to be independent of the gun lobby. In fact, when the Philadelphia Inquirer endorsed me just recently, one of the primary reasons why they endorsed me and criticized my opponent is because he's too close to the gun lobby. We don't need an attorney general who's too close to the gun lobby.
But don't you have to work with the legislature? I mean, the attorney general has certain powers, but you still have to go through the legislature if you're going to change some of these laws.
Each of the things I just described does not require legislative approval. Certainly, if the legislature wanted to pass universal background checks, then I could enforce it. In the absence of that, I can work directly with the NRA and with other organizations to close those loopholes. We just saw the New York Attorney General do the same thing there to close the gun show loophole in New York, and we're going to try and do the same thing here in Pennsylvania. Look, I have great respect for the important role that guns play in the heritage of this Commonwealth, and I strongly and vigorously will defend people's Second Amendment rights. But I also will strongly and vigorously defend people's rights not to be shot in their communities. There are too many people struggling because of gun violence across Pennsylvania, and particularly right here in the city of Philadelphia, and they need an attorney general who's going to stand up for them and protect their interests, protect their rights, and make our communities safer.
What do you make of the fact that the NRA has sued or certainly took efforts to sue certain municipalities, including Philadelphia, that wanted their own gun laws?
My opponent gave them that authority to do that, which the Supreme Court ultimately found to be unconstitutional. And I agreed with the Supreme Court. It was unconstitutional. Look, there are certain communities in Pennsylvania that are racked by gun violence more than others, Norristown and Chester and Philadelphia. And I think it's important for them to be able to take steps to make their community safer. And I will work with them in that effort.
Are there any gun laws that you would not enforce as Attorney General?
No, look, of course not. I mean, there are laws on the books that I might not like, whether it's related to guns or other things. But it's my job to enforce the laws of this Commonwealth as Attorney General, and I will do that.
We're almost having a break here. Kathleen Kane, there were certain laws that she said she would not enforce as Attorney General, one having to do with marriage equality. Mm-hmm.
For me, the litmus test is constitutionality. I think it is critically important that an attorney general support the laws of this Commonwealth, but not do something that they perceive to be unconstitutional. The laws allow the attorney general to opine as to constitutionality, obviously reserving final judgment for the state Supreme Court. If I believe an action is unconstitutional, I am not going to take it, but I wouldn't take it in my capacity as a private lawyer or as a lawyer in my capacity with the state or with the county. I think it's important that folks know that constitutionality is my litmus test.
That's Josh Shapiro, again, a Democratic candidate for Attorney General, joining us in this hour of Radio Times to tell us what he would do if he gets elected next week. And you can join our conversation calling us at 1-888-477-9499. It's your election, folks. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, your chance to ask a candidate what he will do. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Josh Shapiro, Democratic candidate for Attorney General here in Pennsylvania. Let me read an email from Wendy in Westchester. She says, I've spoken with both candidates for Attorney General. While I like them both, I hope that we get a return to integrity, ethics, and professionalism in our Office of Attorney General, no matter who is elected, along with answers to a lot of unresolved issues from that office. So clearly—
I agree, Wendy.
I mean, do you see this as the top priority?
I think job number one has to be restoring integrity and fairness. Look, people have to have faith in their justice system. They have to have faith in the person leading it. They have to have faith knowing that you're going to execute the laws without fear and without favor. And from that, then usually good things can come. I'm not going to please all the people all the time. No political leader will. And I think it would be foolish for me to sit here on the air and say people are going to agree with me 100% of the time. But if they can have faith that the decisions I'm making are being made with integrity, based in ethics, and are being made for the best interests of the people of Pennsylvania, then once again our democracy can be healed and can improve from where it's been.
Well, we know the juvenile justice system has gone, you know, has been under attack in part because of what happened in Luzerne County. Can you say to our listeners that they can have a sense of confidence in our justice system in Pennsylvania?
Right now, I think there's a lot of questions for the ethics and integrity reasons we talked about, but also because I think we need real criminal justice reform in Pennsylvania. You know, I'm privileged to serve as chairman of the Justice Reinvestment Initiative. I was appointed not just by Governor Wolf, but by Republican and Democratic leaders in the state to that capacity. We've been meeting for a year. We'll be putting out next month a series of reforms in the criminal justice area to try and make our system fair. Right now, we see too much bias baked into the system, hurting people of color, sentences that are increased, bail that is higher for people of color, for example. We see a system where sentencing needs to be reformed. And we see a system where we're incarcerating people who, you know, are drug addicts and mentally ill who should be diverted from the system because they're not violent, they're not a threat to others, and they should be getting the treatment that they need. And by the way, that's good for that individual. It saves the taxpayers a whole lot of money, and it makes our community safer. So criminal justice reform is a critical thing to me, and as the chief legal officer of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, I'll continue to lend my voice for that.
Are you talking about the heroin epidemic or the problems of opioid addiction oftentimes leading to heroin?
Marty, I talk about this wherever I go in this Commonwealth, and it is now the number one accidental killer in Pennsylvania, heroin and opioids. We need to have a comprehensive plan. It's something I've been working on for many years, and it starts with this, a recognition that we need to understand the difference between someone who is dealing drugs, who is a criminal, and someone who is addicted to drugs and nonviolent who needs treatment. So we need to begin diverting those who need treatment out of the criminal justice system into treatment, number one. Number two, we must partner with the medical community to get them to reduce their prescribing of opioid painkillers and make sure that we combat illegal drugs, whether they're on the street corner or whether it's because of deceptive marketing by pharmaceutical companies in a boardroom. We also have to make sure that docs are participating in a statewide database so that people can't doctor shop and get these prescriptions across the board and then sell them illegally. We have to then also make sure from a law enforcement perspective, we are coordinating with our DAs and area attorneys general, as I have already begun doing, to make sure that we stem the flow of heroin and illegal pills throughout our Commonwealth. We've got to make sure that every law enforcement officer is armed with naloxone or Narcan, which is the life-saving antidote to reverse an overdose. We need a comprehensive approach, marrying together drug and alcohol treatment, law enforcement, with a leader like me who understands this issue and understands how important it is to combat this if we're going to save lives and make our community safer.
Is that an argument for slowly legalizing drug use?
I do not support that. I was in support of medicinal marijuana. I would support reducing some of the penalties for people possessing a small amount of marijuana, but I would not support legalizing recreational marijuana use.
The way Philadelphia has basically
Philadelphia
for small
and Pittsburgh have begun to, you know, reduce it almost like a summary. They create a summary fence, almost like a traffic ticket for small amounts of marijuana. We shouldn't be locking someone up for years for having a joint. I think that is not an approach we should take. But I don't favor, you know, fully legalizing drugs or marijuana.
Do Pennsylvania's and even the federal government's environmental laws make fracking safe if they were fairly and equitably applied?
This is another defining issue in this race and key difference between me and my opponent. You know, there's a constitutional right you and I and all your listeners have in Pennsylvania to clean air and pure water. And I think it's been too long. In fact, it's really never happened where the attorney general has stood up and held the polluting companies or the frackers accountable for what they do to our drinking water. I am going to beef up the environmental crimes division of the attorney general's office. I'm going to make sure we go after polluters, go after frackers if they're polluting our drinking water and undermining your constitutional right to clean air and pure water. Look, fracking is an important part of the economy here in Pennsylvania, but we've seen too many people's drinking water compromised. We also see landowners in other parts of Pennsylvania not getting the royalties that they were promised by these fracking companies. When a company does it the right way, they'll have no problem with me as their attorney general. In fact, I'll help them by rooting out those people who are cutting corners, those companies that are cutting corners. But if you cut corners and you undermine the quality of our drinking water and you violate people's constitutional rights to clean air and pure water, I'm going to hold you accountable.
So you can have safe fracking in Pennsylvania?
Absolutely. And we have a number of companies that are doing it safely now, but we also have a number of companies that are cutting corners. And those who are cutting corners are going to be held accountable. Those who are not cutting corners, who are investing in the personnel, who are investing in systems, who are investing in environmental protection, are going to receive praise from me and are going to finally receive a level playing field, because we're going to root out those fly-by-night companies that are cutting corners.
That's Josh Shapiro, Democratic candidate for Attorney General here in Pennsylvania, telling us what he wants to do if he wins next week. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me get some callers in. We've got Steve from Spring Grove, Pennsylvania. Steve, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I have kind of a serious question. I'm an SSL holder. I have called multiple occasions, both to the FBI and to the state DOJ, to try to stop straw purchasers. I know for a fact that on four different occasions I've called to try to see if I could stop the sale, and both the Fed and the state both said their hands are tied, you have to proceed with the sale.
Well,
what are you going to do about it?
All right. The idea, here's someone who believes that he saw straw purchasers and want someone to intervene, and they're saying, no, we have to have the sale in order, I guess, what, to prove it's a straw purchase?
Steve, I appreciate the call, and I appreciate that you're obviously a responsible gun owner, and I think you need a partner in law enforcement who's going to help make sure that we stop these straw purchases, and that's something I'm going to do. It's a aspect of the Attorney General's office we're going to beef up. We're going to focus more resources and attention on it. We're going to partner with local law enforcement, and we're going to partner with responsible people like you, Steve, so thanks for your call.
But is he correct in that you have to have the purchase in order to prove it's a straw purchase?
Yeah, I'm not quite sure the situation that Steve is raising, but obviously if we get wind that these things are going down, then we're going to have our investigators on scene and doing everything we can to combat straw purchasers.
Let me ask you about statute of limitations, where you stand on that, especially as it relates to allegations of child sex abuse.
Child sex abuse is something that we must be vigilant in pursuing, whether it happened yesterday or whether it happened decades ago. And I'm pleased to see that the Attorney General's office has conducted at least one grand jury, and it appears from media reports others, into clergy sex abuse. It is absolutely horrific to hear these stories. And I've been out in Altoona, Johnstown, listening to victims, listening to some of the victims' advocates talking about what occurred there. In fact, as chairman of PCCD, I brought resources with me to make sure that they had the help they needed to provide to survivors. Protecting victims is of critical importance to me. It's also critically important that we get them justice, and one of the best ways to get them justice is to expand the statute of limitations bill. I supported Representative Rossi's bill, himself a victim of clergy sex abuse when he was a child. That bill passed in the House of Representatives. It went to the Senate, and actually under the leadership of my opponent and his committee, it was watered down, and a watered-down version was passed in the Senate. Now, he says he was for the amendment, but for the bill. I'm not quite sure where he stands on that issue. He can answer for himself. But the reality is we need to have tougher laws when it comes to child, people who abuse our children sexually or otherwise. I support that, and I'm going to be working as hard as I can in the next legislative session using my bully pulpit as Attorney General to get the legislature to act.
And what would be an appropriate statute of limitations?
Well, that's going to be up to the legislature, but I think Representative Rossi's bill that expands it and extends it is certainly wise.
Let me get, looks like Margaret from Philadelphia to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Margaret. Go ahead. You're on the air. Hi, Margaret. Go ahead.
Hi. Yes, my question is the AG's Office of Consumer Protection seems in some cases like an office of consumer suppression. Despite TV news and Philadelphia Inquirer exposés, some companies with hundreds of victims continue to not be investigated. And the AG's office has no right to know law with other government agencies, so citizens can't really, they have no course recourse if the case is heard, as it is apparently, at least in the one I'm thinking of, by one agent. I'm not saying that agent's crooked, but all the cards are on that agent's table, and once it happens with a person, they have no further recourse for the victim. You can't go anywhere.
Well, Margaret, let me give Josh Shapiro a chance to respond.
Margaret, you raise a critically important issue, which is how are we going to protect consumers in Pennsylvania? I talked about this earlier in the program. We have not done a good job over decades in the office of doing that. I am going to dramatically beef up our public protection division. I've talked about being the people's attorney general, and one of the things that we're going to do is be out there fighting hard for consumers in Pennsylvania. Margaret, I met a mom recently in Butler County who has such a severely allergic child. She's so allergic to nuts that she has to carry 3 EpiPens with her in case her daughter even comes in contact with nuts. Those 3 EpiPens have skyrocketed in price by 600%. I will not tolerate price gouging by pharmaceutical companies. I won't tolerate price gouging by anyone in Pennsylvania against Pennsylvania consumers. I'm going to crack down on scams against our seniors, scams against our veterans. And you know what scams I'm talking about? These are those telemarketing calls you get during dinner where they're asking you for your bank account information, or you know, the person from a computer company saying you have malware on your computer, give me $299, I'll clean it up. Or the fake IRS notices that you get in the mail that seem official, but they're not. You fill it out, next thing you know, your accounts have been compromised. We cannot tolerate this. I'm going to create an attorney general's office that is far more outward facing, where people can literally walk into an office here in Philadelphia or across Pennsylvania and blow the whistle or share information about these types of scams against consumers and scams against the public. I want to hear from you, and I think the attorney general's office is uniquely situated to do it. The statute calls for the attorney general to do it, and I will be very serious about being the people's attorney general.
Margaret, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Where do you stand on civil forfeiture?
I think that's an issue, obviously, the legislature has been looking at. It needs to be reformed. That's something that I know is an ongoing discussion. I hope they reform it. I hope they pass new legislation, and certainly I'll enforce it.
A tweet from looks like Dr. Kelly. Kathleen Cain was a whistleblower. She exposed the shameful attitudes and practices in Harrisburg. Is there some truth to that?
Well, we've talked about this during the scope of our discussion today. Those emails that have surfaced, it's critically important that we get them out. And I have said as Attorney General, I would release those emails. And I will look through those emails to see if crimes were committed, if there were ethics violations, if there were HR violations. We need to begin to heal our justice system, repair our democracy. And one of the best ways we can do that is to expose those emails and what came with it.
You also call for fighting for fair education funding, and some changes have been made in the formula. Some people feel they haven't really gone far enough. What would be fair from your perspective?
Fair is ultimately going to be defined by the legislature and the governor, and potentially by the courts. And here's why I say that. We have a constitutional provision in this Commonwealth that says each child is guaranteed the right to a thorough and efficient education system. Now, last time I checked the Constitution, it doesn't just list certain zip codes where they get that thorough and efficient education system. It's all students in Pennsylvania. And I believe that in certain zip codes in Pennsylvania, some urban, some rural, some right around us here in Philadelphia, Marty, that dream is not realized. That right is not realized by our children, I should say. And I think it's critically important as Attorney General that we uphold everyone's constitutional rights, including the students here in Pennsylvania. There is a case pending before the state Supreme Court now challenging our state, you know, funding based on that constitutional provision. I'll be watching that very, very closely to see how that court goes. We have seen in other states, in Maryland and actually playing out right now in real time in Connecticut, where the courts have actually said that the constitutional right to whatever their equivalent is of a thorough and efficient education was not being met. And in the case at least of Connecticut, they sort of remanded the case to the Attorney General's office to come up with the proper formula. Hmm. I'd like to see that go to the legislature and get them to fairly and fully fund our schools across the board. Look, we understand that this is not just a constitutional right, but if we fail to educate our children, then we are doing everything, then we are exacerbating the school-to-prison pipeline. We have to do everything in our power to educate our kids, give them economic opportunities going forward, and keep them away from crime and instead being productive members of our society. And it starts with a good, strong, thorough, and efficient education system.
Let me get your response to FBI Director Comey's announcement on Friday about emails on disgraced Congressman Wiener's server or computer that may or may not be relevant into an investigation into Hillary Clinton's server. As a lawyer, a potential leading law enforcement officer of Pennsylvania, what's your response to that?
I was very concerned by some of the language that was used in that letter and the many dangling questions that were left as a result of that letter. It's my view that those emails should be released. Let the American people see what it is that that FBI Director Comey has seen, or I guess is in the process of seeing now that they just got the warrant. But I think the American people, with 8 days to go before the election, have a right to know what was on that server. So I'd like to see it be released. I'd like to see far more openness and transparency.
Do you think it was political on his part?
I don't know. I don't know the FBI director. It seems that it violated standard protocol by the feds. You saw, I think, about 50 former federal prosecutors of both parties stand up and say that it really did violate their protocol. But ultimately, I think what's important is that there be a full accounting of the American people before they go vote next Tuesday. And look, you know, about 40 million Americans will vote by the time we get to vote in Pennsylvania on Tuesday because of early voting. There are people voting right now with these questions out there, and I think it's important that they be the emails be released and those questions be answered.
So we make it easier to vote in Pennsylvania?
Absolutely.
Just based on what you just said there?
Absolutely. When I was in the legislature, I pushed for all kinds of reforms to make it easier to vote. You know, obviously early voting, same day registration, things like that, I think would be really critically important to strengthen our democracy.
There have been some attorney generals that served in Pennsylvania and have used that as a stepping stone for either governor or higher office. If you win this seat, will you serve out your term? Do you see this as a stepping stone to other higher positions, either in Pennsylvania or perhaps in Washington, D.C.?
Of course I will serve out my term. I think, Marty, you asked me this question back in April, and I answered it the same way. Look, I believe that the role of attorney general is perhaps the most impactful job in state government, with all due respect to other statewide office holders. You have the power to be able to make decisions over people's life and liberty and to be able to strengthen our democracy and solve major problems that exist in our society today, whether it's gun violence, whether it's the heroin and opioid epidemic, whether it's making sure consumers are protected. I mean, these are issues that day in and day out people struggle with, and the Attorney General is uniquely situated to be able to address it. That's why I've put forth plans throughout this campaign to be able to address these issues. In terms of my future, God willing, I'm elected on Tuesday. I will serve a full term. And if I have the blessing of my four children and my wife, I'll run for another term. I am so looking forward to the opportunity of serving the people of Pennsylvania if they give me the honor of being their attorney general.
Josh Shapiro, thanks for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Democratic candidate for attorney general here in Pennsylvania. There is one more debate, I'm told, on Tuesday, Wednesday? Okay, later this week, and certainly Election Day is next Tuesday. I'm Marty Moscowing. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscowane, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Lewisburg Federal Penitentiary in central Pennsylvania is a violent place where inmate-on-inmate attacks are all too common, some resulting in death. NPR teamed up with the Marshall Project to investigate why this prison is so dangerous for inmates and what the facility is doing about it. And we asked NPR's Joseph Shapiro, no relation to our previous guest, who's been covering this story, to explain, and he joins us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. And Joseph Shapiro, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. Thanks for doing the Shapiro theme today.
I know. That was kind of a happy accident for us, so thanks for coming in. Tell us about Lewisburg Federal Penitentiary. What kind of inmates are generally incarcerated there?
Lewisburg is has a special management unit. So it's a place where they take about, they have about 1,000, 1,100 of the prisoners right now who are considered some of the most disruptive, violent, dangerous prisoners in the federal system. They take them, bring them to Lewisburg. They go through a sort of a behavior modification program, and then they can go back to the regular population. Now, what we found, actually, by the way, is that some of those are supposed, you know, these people are supposed to be these very dangerous inmates. Many of them are ones who have significant mental health issues, and others, as one former staffer told me, they were sort of were in the wrong place at the wrong time and end up at this place. So even though it's supposed to be for these very dangerous prisoners, we found it wasn't always that way. But what you get is a lot of violence when these people are there, partly by way for a number of reasons. We looked at the restraint use. We looked at the lack of mental health care. And this idea of double cell solitary confinement, this odd thing that seems like a contradiction, that you put one man in solitary confinement and then give him a cellmate in these very tiny cells. It's a prescription for violence.
Well, and you're talking about a cell that's, what, 6 feet by 10 feet?
At Lewisburg, many of them are just 6 feet by 10 feet. Some are a little bit more. But basically, the size, the smaller than the size of a spot that you park your car in, smaller than than that. And some of these, by the way, we did a story back in the spring about an Illinois prison where the cells were the size of a king size bed. Two
wow.
men, two bunks, a toilet, sink, and you're there 23 to 24 hours a day.
What is the thinking behind that? Is it because of overcrowding, or is there some
We think it's overcrowding. The Bureau of Prisons defended its use of double cell solitary confinement. And by the way, 80% of the men in solitary confinement in the federal prison system, at least about 80%, are in these double cells. And the Bureau of Prisons told us, oh, well, it cuts down on suicide. We know, in fact, that when people are put in solitary confinement for long periods of time, suicides go up. And it is a fact. If you put a cellmate in there, suicides go down. But what we found was that homicide goes up. That's how we got to Lewisburg prison, because there were several serious attacks, inmate attacks, scores of them last year, but two of them resulted in deaths. That's what got our attention on Lewisburg.
Oh, absolutely. And I do want to talk about one or two of the prisoners, but I also want to make sure our listeners understand about what an ambulatory restraint is.
So there are different kinds of restraints, but ambulatory restraints are where you're somebody's taken out of a cell. If there's some problem created, if they're fighting a cellmate, their hands are shackled and their wrists are shackled and their ankles are shackled rather, and there's also a chain around their waist, around their belly, so you can walk. It's hard to do that, but you can move. There's another kind of restraint that we found was used, 4-point restraint, where somebody's taken to a special cell, that they're painted pink at Lewisburg, they're put on a concrete mattress, their legs are shackled at one end of the mattress, their arms are pulled over above their heads and shackled to the other end of the mattress. That usually somebody's there for a few hours, several hours.
And what your story is about, and the Marshall Project as well, is about inmates who essentially say, I don't want to share a cell with this particular prisoner, and then they get punished for that behavior. I do want to talk about Royce Brown, and then we have a really disturbing clip from one of your stories about him being put in 4-point restraints. First of all, who's Royce Brown?
Royce Brown was an inmate who went to Lewisburg in 2014. By the way, he's out. I hope he may be
yes.
listening to your show right now. He lives in Wilmington. He's been out for over a year. He's trying to start his life again. He's a truck driver. He's trying to start a business. He's trying to buy a truck. He ended up in Lewisburg. He'd been in and out of the prison system for a long time over different things, drug charges, and he's a guy, he says he likes to challenge authority, which doesn't always work well in prison. I guess because of some of his challenges, he would be charged with face discipline for getting in fights with staff, and he ended up at Lewisburg. But and he didn't feel he belonged at Lewisburg because he was almost done with his sentence. He had 10 months to go, and Lewisburg was a program for 18 months. And so he got there, and he was sort of angry and despondent that he was there. And right away, there's a dispute with a staff, and he ends up in restraints. And the tape that we had was he was already in a restraint cell. He was shackled. And a corrections officer claims that Royce tried to headbutt him. Royce says he was attacked by the guard. We have the tape, but it doesn't start at that point, so we don't know exactly what happened. But we do see him being dragged out of the cell, strapped down on a stretcher, taken to the restraint room, put in 4-point restraints.
Let's give it a listen. And I should say to our listeners, this is disturbing.
Inmate Brown is currently in ambulatory restraints during a lieutenant's check at approximately 8 o'clock. The MA became disruptive and assaulted the lieutenant while he's doing a two-hour check. Authorization for immediate four-point restraints has been given by the warden. We will now currently place the MA into four-point restraints. MA Brown, do not resist my staff, so you understand.
I didn't assault nobody!
A little bit of time.
And we hear Royce Brown saying, I didn't assault nobody. And what we hear, Joseph, is a prison official essentially documenting what is going on.
Right. So they do these tapes to try to show that they follow the correct procedures. We try to get some of these with a Freedom of Information Act request, and they wouldn't release them. They say that it shows their procedures. They want to keep those secret or not reveal them. But Royce Brown was facing an assault charge, assaulting these prison officials, these corrections officers, and his lawyer got the tapes. And once they got the tapes, these charges were never filed against them. It's interesting. You hear him. He's sort of despondent. He is not struggling. In one of the tapes, by the way, the corrections officer says, "You're resisting my staff. Stop." And he's not. There are people, guards are holding him by several of them are holding him down. He's not struggling. They say that they claim that he was resisting because he was somehow puffing out his stomach, and so that they couldn't put the chain on. Hmm. And he's saying, you know, I'm not doing that. That's just, you know, he says, I'm fat. That's just my body. I'm not doing that. I'm not resisting. So the things that get called resisting, you can get charged with assaulting an officer and this happened to Royce Brown, if you threaten them or curse at them. And so, but in the tape, the officers are very careful. They're methodical the way they chain him. But it's not like he's struggling.
Hmm. There's another inmate that you document, a man named Sebastian Richardson. And again, he refused a cellmate who had a reputation for being
right,
difficult, even dangerous. And he did not want to share his 6x10 cell with this man. And he was they used the ambulatory restraints on him, and also they cuffed him for something like 28 days.
Right. And also the four-point restraints with Sebastian Richardson. You know, this also with Royce Brown, one of the things that got him restrained was he too objected, had a cellmate he couldn't get along with. And the inmates tell us that the one way that you can the only way that you can get a change of assignment is you get in a fight with a cellmate. We talked to 20 inmates. We found 20 inmates who, either in lawsuits or interviews with us, say that they were punished just for that, for refusing a cellmate. And as you said, Sebastian Richardson, they brought this man to his door who was sort of speaking incoherently, a man who was had a reputation in that prison for assaulting other cellmates. We found other inmates who'd been at Lewisburg who knew this man. And Sebastian Richardson said, no, this is not safe. You're bringing him in to create problems. I'm not going to take him. And by the way, to refuse a cellmate, what they do is to open the door and put somebody new into your cell. The person is already in the cell. You have to put your hands through a slot in the door and agree to be handcuffed. Now, that's a dangerous time because then they bring in the new cellmate, undo his handcuffs. That means one person, Sebastian Richardson, would have been in handcuffs while the other man was out. There are a lot of assaults. We found records of a lot of assaults happen when one person is in cuffs, the other one's not. That often happens also if somebody's being taken to recreation, which they get maybe an hour a day. So we found 20 inmates who told us that they were punished because they faced a situation where they were going to be given a dangerous cellmate, someone they thought was a danger to them. They refused, and the result was they'd be put in restraints. Usually it's for several hours. Sometimes it'd be a few days. But in Sebastian Richardson's case, 28 days, including four-point restraint for one day, and also a second time for 21 days. He's pretty stubborn to say, I'm not going to take that cellmate. Most prisoners would eventually sort of relent and say, okay, get me out of here. I'll take that cellmate. He he was stubborn and for 28 days in restraints. And by the way, he describes the conditions. It was winter. They put him in a cell. They opened he was in restraints. He couldn't, he had trouble eating, had to sleep on the floor because he couldn't get to the top bunk in his restraints. And we heard lots of inmates tell us this story, that in the winter, the corrections officers would open the window in the cell and let them freeze.
And what you're also describing is that I believe Richardson and some others, and he has filed suit, that
yes.
they had to drink out of the toilet because of the restraints didn't allow them to turn the faucet on.
Right. And there were actually two lawsuits that charged that, and not the Richardson, not Sebastian Richardson, but two other people who said that they couldn't do that. They couldn't get water, so they drank out of these filthy toilets.
So it's accept the cellmate that you fear and perhaps even live in fear, or resist the cellmate and be put in restraints. That was the choice some of these inmates were given?
Yes, and another inmate who's currently at Lewisburg, named Demetrius Hill, currently assigned to Lewisburg, told us that and actually many inmates that we talked to said that the thing they feared most at Lewisburg was their own cellmate. Because the Bureau of Prisons says they try to match compatible cellmates, and they have a process for doing that, but it doesn't always work. A lot of these people have serious mental health issues. Sometimes you're put in with somebody who you're not going to get along with, or you've had problems with. Sebastian Richardson says, by the way, they said, okay, you can come out of restraints if you agree to take this person, and it was somebody who assaulted him at a previous prison, and he says they knew that. But and he still refused, and that's one reason why he stayed there for 28 days.
Let me quote from the Bureau of Prisons responding to NPR Marshall Project investigation. I can't read the whole thing, but it says here, we take very seriously every allegation of misconduct, referring these allegations for investigation to our Office of Internal Affairs or to the Justice Department's Office of Inspector General. Our track record demonstrates that when our staff are found guilty of misconduct, we take firm action. Going on from there, describing this special management unit. What is your response to the Bureau of Prisons' response to your stories?
We called them back after we ran the stories on last week and asked them if they wanted to add anything. We had been trying to get interviews with them before. I hope this is right, that they take this seriously. They say that they want to provide humane treatment for everyone who's in their custody. They say that's their top priority, so that's good. But what we found at Lewisburg was disturbing. It suggests that this is a place where they don't hold to that standard that they hold themselves to. This is from the reporting that Christy Thompson at the Marshall Project and I did. We found a pattern of lots of problems at Lewisburg, the heavy use of restraints, the lack of mental health care, and then this use of the double cell solitary confinement.
We're almost out of time here, but are you suggesting that Lewisburg and other federal facilities not use restraints at all?
The Federal Bureau of Prisons has rules about restraints that it's supposed to be – it's permitted, but it's a safety measure. It should be used when an inmate is a danger, maybe to himself or to other inmates or prison staff, and then only as a short-term and last alternative. What we found at Lewisburg was that it's used long-term, and we've heard inmates saying this is being used as punishment, not as a safety measure.
And will you continue to investigate Lewisburg?
Yes, we want to continue to look at Lewisburg, and we've filed Freedom of Information Act requests, and we hope that we'll get more information from that, and there are other cases that we're looking at. So, yes, we want to continue to look at Lewisburg.
Well, Joseph Shapiro, thank you for joining us today in Radio Times.
All right, Marty, thank you. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. NPR reporter who's been covering Lewisburg Federal Penitentiary in central Pennsylvania. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out much more about this program. You can download a podcast of the show. Find us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. I'm Marty Moscowing. Thanks for joining us.